and Cardigan restrained anyone who tried to quicken the pace. He kept them instead in perfect formation. Mounted on their fine horses, dressed in what were very colorful uniforms, with their lance and saber points glittering in the bright sunlight, the hundreds of horsemen must have been an inspiring sight. But they were no match for modern cannons and explosive shells. The Russian guns began to fire upon them, and the very first casualty was Nolan, who was struck in the chest by a shell splinter and killed. Actually, he should not even have been there. He instead should have returned to Raglan after delivering his message. However, Nolan was not one to miss the chance for combat, and so he had unofficially attached himself to the charge. At the moment, just before he was killed, he had jumped out to a position in advance of the entire light brigade. And there are some reports that when he saw that they were heading down the valley rather than towards the redoubts, he rode out in front to try to redirect them, but then was killed before he could do so. The truth of that assertion will, of course, never be known. As they drove deeper into the valley, more and more Russian guns could bear on them, and their ranks were ravaged by shot. It's been calculated subsequently that it would have taken them about 7 minutes to travel the entire length of the valley. And those 7 minutes must have been a terrifying time for the men and their horses. Finally, as they got within about 50 yards of the Russian battery at the far end, that's when they broke into a true charge. The surviving troopers now got a chance for some revenge, and they were able to slash at the Russian gunners with their sabers or spear them with their lances. Soon, however, the masses of nearby Russian cavalry came forward, and the scattered British survivors were then forced to withdraw and attempt to escape back the very same way they'd come. So this entailed traversing the entire valley once again, which gave the Russians yet another chance to blast away at them with their cannons. Cardigan had been among the very first to reach the Russian guns, but he seems to have considered actual hand-to-hand combat beneath his aristocratic dignity. Therefore, apparently viewing his job as all done, he turned his horse and rode back through the valley. A better leader would have tried to organize his soldiers, either to continue the attack or to retreat in a coherent fashion. But Cardigan basically abandoned his men, leaving it to the junior officers to rally them and to attempt to lead the remnants back to safety. Out of 666 men known to have participated in the charge, 110 were killed, 129 wounded, and 32 taken prisoner. That's a total casualty rate of over 40%. The horses suffered even more, with 56% of them being killed or mortally wounded. Decimated by these losses, the Light Brigade was effectively finished as a fighting unit. The observers of the event, including Raglan, could not believe what they had witnessed. One of the French generals who had witnessed the attack commented, "It is magnificent, but it is not war. It is madness." And that's a fitting summation of the extraordinarily brave but utterly foolish attack. Technically, the charge reached its objective, but since they had only killed a few Russians and then had to retreat, they had really accomplished nothing at all of strategic importance, and they had done so at a very great cost to themselves. Raglan, Lucan, and Cardigan would spend the rest of their lives arguing over who had been at fault, and they all, rather uncharitably, tried to place most of the blame on the one man who could not defend himself, the dead Nolan. Their careers all survived to varying degrees, but all three men eventually came away tarnished from the debacle. The incident quickly became a legend, especially after England's poet laureate, Alfred Lord Tennyson, wrote his famous poem lauding the courage of the Light Brigade. That poem was an immediate hit, and largely because of it, the charge is now remembered as a glorious moment for British arms. Well into the next century, school children would be required to memorize and recite Tennyson's stirring lines. The siege of Sevastopol would drag on for almost a year, until at last the city fell. By that point, however, public opinion in Britain and France had turned strongly against the war, and so a hurried peace treaty was signed in which Russia lost a little bit of territory and promised not to expand its naval presence in the Black Sea. In order to achieve that rather inconclusive result, a total of 500,000 men had lost their lives. At the start of this lecture, I mentioned that among the legacies of the Crimean War were three distinctive items of clothing that still exist today, so I suppose I should name them. The first is the raglan, a kind of loose overcoat with sleeves reaching to the collar but without shoulder seams. This was something that was habitually worn by him. The second is the cardigan sweater. Lord Cardigan's original version of this garment was a knitted woolen vest, although today the term is applied to almost any sweater with buttons. Finally, there is the balaclava, a knitted wool hat which covers the entire head that was popular among the soldiers who had to endure the long winter siege of that city. In closing, it seems appropriate to end with a few lines from Tennyson's famous poem, which, after all, did so much to immortalize the charge. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die, into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honor the charge they made, honor the Light Brigade, noble 600.
Lecture 15, Greasy Grass, Custer's Last Stand.
In early June of 1876, on the eastern bank of the Rosebud River, in what was then termed the Montana Territory, Chief Sitting Bull of the Hunkpapa Lakota prepared himself to undergo a grueling and bloody ceremony. Sitting Bull, at this time, was 45 years old, and he walked with a pronounced limp from a gunshot injury received when he had challenged and killed a rival chief as a young man. This was an act that had gained him much fame as a warrior. Regarded as now being too old, though, to still be an active fighter, he had grown into a new role as the widely revered spiritual leader of his people. For this ritual, a cottonwood tree was cut down, stripped of its branches, except for one at the top, painted red, and placed upright in a hole in the ground. Sitting Bull sat down with his back against this pole, and his brother took up an awl, inserted it shallowly into Sitting Bull's left arm just above the wrist, and used it to pry up a small patch of skin. He then sliced off the elevated section of skin, leaving a small open wound. Sitting Bull remained impassive, betraying none of the agony that he was surely feeling. While this process was repeated 49 more times along the entire length of his arm. Then, 50 additional tiny chunks of flesh were sliced out of Sitting Bull's right arm so that the blood ran freely down his mutilated limbs. Only then did he arise and, begin to dance around the pole under the bright sun. He danced for hours, some say an entire day and night, with his blood dripping on the ground and eventually coagulating along his maimed arms. This was one of the most sacred ceremonies of the Lakota. It was known as the Sun Dance. Finally, Sitting Bull collapsed, and then he had a vision in which he saw a large number of white soldiers and horses falling upside down into an Indian village, dropping, as he put it, like grasshoppers. When the gathered Lakota heard his vision, their confidence soared, because it clearly foretold a great victory in their current struggle with the mounted cavalry troopers of the United States Army. By the end of that month, Sitting Bull's vision would come true at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or to call it by the name that the Native Americans use, the Battle of the Greasy Grass. There, on the afternoon of June 25th, the Lakota and their allies would wipe out George Armstrong Custer, along with over 250 men of the U.S. 7th Cavalry. George Armstrong Custer was a polarizing figure who provoked strong responses from everyone around him. Both his superiors and his subordinates seemed either to love and admire him or to utterly despise him. He had grown up as the favorite child in a large family and managed to gain admission to West Point. Charismatic and exuberant, as well as impudent and rebellious, he was popular with his fellow cadets. But he was constantly getting into trouble and was forever in peril of amassing enough demerits to be expelled from the academy. He ended up graduating last in his class. But with the Civil War breaking out, officers, even inexperienced ones, were in great demand in the rapidly expanding Northern Army. Custer had a knack for ingratiating himself with his superiors, and he rose quickly through the ranks. He was fearless, and he proved to be a naturally gifted cavalry commander. These qualities, coupled with his energy and boundless ambition, helped him to become the youngest general in the entire army by his mid-20s. As a tactician, he favored bold charges, which, while usually effective, could sometimes verge on rashness. Custer was also a shameless self-promoter. He loved to stand out and to be noticed, and so he concocted an outrageous personal uniform that he wore, which consisted of a velveteen jacket decorated with large gold loops on the sleeves. Combined with a bright red tie and with his long blonde hair falling in a mass of curly locks over his shoulders, he cut a dashing and flamboyant figure. After the war, when the army was cut back to a skeletal force, he was lucky to obtain a position in the West. There, he replaced the costume that he had worn so far with a different but equally distinctive one. This time, he wore a buckskin jacket of very pale leather, whose sleeves and collar were adorned with long fringes. This was supplemented by buckskin pants and a bright red scarf. His strong personality clashed with several of his officers, and his command became split into those who, again, admired and emulated Custer, and those who found him overbearing and egotistical. His stern disciplinary measures also served to alienate some of his men. At one point, 11 of them actually lodged a formal joint complaint against him. Another incident that engendered ill feelings occurred when he evicted some wounded soldiers from a wagon in order to make room for his pet dogs, which had sore paws from stepping on some cactus spines. More seriously, he was court-martialed and suspended for a year when he abruptly abandoned his post without permission and rode 150 miles away to visit his wife. Custer gained a reputation as a so-called Indian fighter, but most of this rested upon a single episode in which a column of his 7th Cavalry ambushed a Cheyenne village, killing a number of them and capturing many others. Labeled the Battle of Washita River, it was hailed as a great victory in the press, although the majority of his victims and captives were women and children rather than warriors. He was next assigned to the Northern Plain Sector, where the indigenous peoples were more vigorously and successfully resisting encroachment upon their lands. There is no way to whitewash the fact that the treatment of the Native Americans by the United States government and its agents during the 19th century was one of the less honorable episodes in American history. It would have been far more honest if the U.S. had simply announced from the outset an intent to displace the tribes from the lands that they occupied and coerce them into giving up their traditional ways of living. Instead, there was a long, painful, drawn-out process of first pushing Native American groups ever further westward, then driving them into ever-shrinking territories, and finally attempting to compel them to adopt a sedentary agricultural lifestyle on reservations. The whole process was given a thin legal veneer through a seemingly endless succession of treaties. These were often intentionally deceptive or flawed. It was common for government representatives to persuade one chief or a small number of them to sign a treaty, and then to claim that it applied to dozens of others who had not. If no pliant chief was available, they would simply create one of their own in order to obtain a signature. Another common tactic was negotiating agreements that were to be valid for 50 years or even forever, and then secretly changing the duration of the treaty to 1 or 5 years without informing the Indians of the switch. Finally, if the terms of a treaty became inconvenient, it would simply be ignored or revoked, no matter what legally binding promises may have been made. The lifestyle of the Plains Indians had been transformed only a few generations earlier by the introduction of the horse and the gun. This enabled a true nomadic existence in which tribes followed the migrations of the enormous herds of buffalo that roamed the plains. Many of these tribes were warrior societies in which social standing was determined by feats of bravery on the battlefield. And so there was near constant warfare and shifting alliances among the different tribes. When white settlers began to encroach onto the plains and to cross them in huge numbers on their way to the Western territories, conflicts inevitably developed. Exacerbating these problems were the completely different attitudes that the two groups had towards property rights. For many of the nomadic Native Americans, one could not own the land. It was simply there. But the settlers were coming from a society whose economy was founded on agriculture. And so it was obsessed with legal partition and ownership of land. By the 1870s, a number of reservations had been established. But many Native Americans preferred to continue their traditional ways of life, freely roaming the plains. The main leader of this latter contingent was Sitting Bull. He resolutely refused to be confined to a reservation. The Battle of the Little Bighorn was precipitated when gold was supposedly discovered in the Black Hills, which were located within the Great Sioux Reservation. And that region was regarded by them as sacred. Nevertheless, the U.S. government began a campaign to buy or just seize these lands. And in December of 1875, it issued an ultimatum stating that any Indian who did not present themselves at a reservation by the end of January would be considered hostiles. This was tantamount to a declaration of war. And it was rather unfair as well, since even those who wished to comply with the ultimatum could not readily travel to reach the reservations during the depths of winter. In the spring of 1876, Sitting Bull summoned those who were opposed to going to the reservations. And a huge gathering of Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho united together. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army had been mobilizing to enforce the ultimatum. And three separate columns of troops were dispatched from different points with the goal of converging on Sitting Bull and his followers in the Montana Territory. Custer and the 7th Cavalry were part of the column that departed from Fort Abraham Lincoln in the Dakota Territory. On June 22nd, Custer and about 600 men were split off and told to scout up the Rosebud River towards the Little Bighorn River. They were searching for the so-called hostiles. The intent was to catch them in a pincer maneuver, with Custer coming from the south and the rest of the column from the north. Custer wanted to travel light and to move quickly, so he rejected the offer of some powerful but unwieldy Gatling guns. This refusal has sometimes been criticized by later commentators, but the main challenge Custer believed that he faced was to pin down the highly mobile Native Americans, and so this was actually a reasonable decision. Custer picked up the trail left by Sitting Bull and his followers. And true to his aggressive nature, he set off in pursuit. He was confident that his force could handle any number of Indians. And his main worry was that the Indians would melt away before he could catch them. So he pushed his men hard, exhausting them with the pace he maintained. However, in this instance, his quarry was looking for a fight. The numbers at Sitting Bull's camp had grown until there were over 6,000 people gathered there, including perhaps 1,500 to 2,000 warriors. Among these was the most renowned war leader of the time, Crazy Horse. Short and wiry, Crazy Horse had quickly built up a reputation as a particularly brave and fierce fighter. More importantly, for the coming battle, he displayed a tactical battlefield awareness of group coordination and movement that was atypical in the individual-centered style of warfare that was normally practiced by the Plains Indians. He also was one of the most hard-line opponents against yielding to the reservation system. When in battle, Crazy Horse was easy to spot, because he habitually painted a zigzag red line down his face. Custer's scouts brought him word that there was a large encampment of Indians on the lower reaches of the Little Bighorn. And on the morning of June 25th, Custer made plans to assault it. To prevent his enemies from escaping, he believed it was necessary to attack from several directions. So he split his force into four separate groups. Custer sent 120 men under Captain Benteen swinging out wide to the left, while Major Reno advanced up the left side of the creek, leading directly to the enemy encampment with 175. And Custer, with the largest unit of 221 troopers, proceeded up the right side. The train of pack mules and some guards, comprising another 150 or so men, brought up the rear. In retrospect, dividing up his already severely outnumbered force was an error. But Custer either did not take seriously the reports of how many enemies he faced, or else he still just believed that he could defeat any number. By mid-afternoon, the columns had become separated. Benteen found nothing on his sweep to the far left, so he swung back and followed Custer's route, although several miles behind him. Reno was heading down into the river valley, while Custer's path on the right bank had led him up onto some high ground on the top of the surrounding escarpment. Around 3 p.m., Reno spotted a village up ahead. A bend in the river prevented him from perceiving that the group of lodges that he could see were just the first of at least 5 such large clusters that continued up along the river for several miles, and that together constitute an enormous gathering of tribes. Completely unaware of what he was getting himself into, Reno at first planned to charge this camp with his 175 men. But as he got closer and could see more and more of it, he started to have second thoughts. And he halted his men, ordering them to dismount and form a line. They opened fire from a distance of about 400 yards. The southern section of the camp that Reno had blundered up against consisted of a circle of 260 lodges belonging to Sitting Bull's Hunkpapa Lakota. Reno's attack set off a panic in the camp, with women and children fleeing away to the north, trying to get away from the incoming shots, and warriors frantically scrambling around searching for their weapons and their horses. As the non-combatants streamed northward, the warriors gravitated southward towards the sound of the shooting, until a mass of 400 or 500 had collected. They began to shoot back at Reno's thin line, and also to move forward to threaten them from the sides. Reno was one of those officers who had an antagonistic relationship with Custer. He was also a very heavy drinker. In one 22-day stretch, Reno had gone through 11 gallons of whiskey. And a number of times during that day's march, he had been observed draining flasks of whiskey. Several of his troopers recalled that his orders sounded slurred. Now, without setting up a rear guard, he told his men to retreat to the cover of a nearby grove of woods. The men fell back in a disorganized fashion and hid among the trees as the volume of fire from the swarms of warriors around them continued to increase. The situation was rapidly deteriorating, and Reno's lack of leadership did not help matters. At one point, a scout that he was talking to was killed by a shot to the head, and the man's blood and brains splattered over Reno, causing him to further lose his composure. Whether due to incompetence or drunkenness, he issued a confused sequence of contradictory orders, first telling his men to mount up, then to dismount, and then to remount. Finally, he just seems to have panicked, and he yelled out, "Any of you men who wish to live, follow me." Whereupon he leapt on his horse and bolted away uphill, abandoning his confused and demoralized men who followed in his wake. By the time they had scrambled up a ravine to the top of the ridge overlooking the river, one quarter of his men were dead, one quarter were missing, and one quarter were either wounded or separated. A trail of bodies marked their flight from the river, and bands of triumphant warriors continued to menace them. Although he knew that Reno had engaged the enemy, Custer was oblivious of the disaster, and he assumed that his encirclement strategy was working. He believed, therefore, that he needed to push forward along the ridge so that he could come at the enemy from the opposite side and trap them. But even while proceeding forward, he seems to have begun having some doubts as to the size of the encampment and as he saw more and more of it, he could tell what he was getting into. So he dispatched a hastily scribbled message to Benteen, which stated, "Benteen, come on, big village, be quick, bring packs." By packs, he apparently meant extra ammunition. But this choice of words would confuse Benteen, who was uncertain whether he was being instructed to bring up the entire ponderous train of pack mules. Benteen was yet another officer who had been feuding with Custer. But then again, Benteen didn't seem to like anyone. He had a surly, prideful personality. And throughout his career, he was consistently hypercritical of his superior officers. Aware of his own propensities, Benteen once admitted, "I've always known that I had the happy facility of making enemies of anyone I ever knew. I couldn't do otherwise. It would be against the grain of myself." As Benteen advanced, he came upon these survivors of Reno's contingent. Although irascible, Benteen was personally brave and reasonably competent, and he managed to stabilize the situation, imposing a degree of order and calm upon Reno's shattered division. Reno and Benteen then had a lengthy and somewhat confused discussion about what they should do next. They decided to wait for the pack train, which arrived shortly after 5 p.m. One small detachment did move forward after the missing Custer, with Benteen following slowly behind it, trailed by Reno and the mules. The leading group ultimately got as far as a piece of high ground known as Weir Peak, but with large, threatening masses of Indians roaming around, Benteen drew back and consolidated all of his forces together at Reno's Hill. All the while, Custer had continued along the high ground, paralleling the river, encountering only light resistance, and he was still intent on his encirclement plan. He split his men into two detachments, with one going forward far enough to sight the non-combatant refugees from the camp gathering near a ford across the river. Cutting off that band was Custer's initial goal, but with so many warriors gathering, the strategy became untenable. Now, it would be a fight for mere survival. Crazy Horse had been slow to get involved in the battle, as he took the time to complete some elaborate religious rituals. But once he rode out, warriors rallied around him in large numbers. He displayed his military acumen by embarking on an encirclement of his own, which trapped Custer's men, who were now assaulted on all sides. One wing of Custer's force drew themselves up on Calhoun Hill. They were surrounded and came under heavy fire, especially from a site called Greasy Grass Ridge. The warriors attacking them were armed with a great variety of weapons, including both antiquated and thoroughly modern guns, as well as bows. Ravaged by a storm of bullets and arrows, this group was overrun and slain. The fate of the detachment accompanying Custer is somewhat disputed, but they seem to have been pushed back in a running fight, with the last survivors, including Custer himself, making a stand on what is now known as Custer Hill. Their remaining horses were shot in order to serve as rudimentary barricades. At some point, a small group broke away and tried to escape, but they were run to ground in a deep ravine and massacred. On the hill, the last knot of defenders was overwhelmed. And up on that hill, the corpses of 42 cavalrymen and 39 horses were found. Exactly how Custer died is another mystery. But his body was discovered with a gunshot wound to the chest and another to his left temple. 17 empty cartridges from his distinctive gun, which was a non-standard issue Remington sporting rifle, were scattered around him. And so this suggests that he had been firing for some time. The corpses of two of his brothers, his brother-in-law, and his nephew also lay nearby. Back on Reno's Hill, the other contingents of the 7th Cavalry now came under siege. Benteen had the soldiers dig in behind improvised breastworks of dirt and slain horses. And for the next day and a half, they managed to hold off the attacking warriors, although in the process, they suffered 50 more casualties. Satisfied with their victory, the triumphant Indians withdrew. And finally, the battered remnants of the 7th were rescued by the arrival of the main army. During the battle, a total of 268 of Custer's men had been killed and 62 wounded. Losses on the Native American side are estimated to have numbered several hundred. Just as the country was celebrating its centennial, news of the shocking defeat broke across the United States. Predictably, there were calls for revenge. And in a series of campaigns, the Free Plains Indians were defeated. The remainder were forced onto reservations. Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse were both eventually compelled to surrender. Crazy Horse was murdered soon after, supposedly while trying to escape, although the accounts of that are much contested. Sitting Bull lived for over a decade more, but then he was also killed under somewhat mysterious circumstances. Reno was put on trial for his poor performance during the battle, but controversially, again, he was acquitted. He was later court-martialed and finally dismissed from the army for excessive drinking. Benteen had a more successful later military career, although he too was suspended at one point for drunkenness. He died in 1898. The Battle of the Little Bighorn, or Greasy Grass, soon became legendary. And as I've indicated throughout this lecture, military historians are still arguing over exactly what happened and who was at fault. It remains one of the most famous, or infamous, depending on your perspective, battles in all of American history. And while it was a rare victory for the indigenous tribes of the Great Plains, it also ultimately really hastened their defeat, as well as the loss of their traditional way of life.
Lecture 16, Isandlwana, 25,000 Zulus undetected.
By the late 19th century, the British colonial empire included nearly a fifth of the world, and in the famous phrase, truly was an empire upon which the sun never set. In the course of amassing and governing this far-flung network of territories, the British army had frequently been called upon to suppress or conquer indigenous groups. Many of these, especially in Africa and Asia, were cultures that were technologically inferior to Victorian Britain. And it was not uncommon for such clashes to pit local warriors armed with spears or muskets against British troops with cannons and modern rifles. The British public became accustomed to hearing accounts of battles in which a relatively small number of highly disciplined British soldiers employing modern weapons were able to defeat much larger bands of less well-organized and more poorly equipped warriors. These incidents tended to reinforce the Victorians' inclination to complacently view their own civilization as superior and to view indigenous peoples as just barbaric savages. These attitudes made the outcome of the Battle of Isandlwana, which took place in Southeast Africa on January 22nd, 1879, all the more shocking. There, an entire army of seasoned redcoats, accompanied by cannon and rocket artillery, was wiped out by a horde of near-naked Zulu warriors wielding spears, clubs, and a smattering of outdated firearms. It ranks among the greatest single-day losses of British troops all the way from the Napoleonic Wars up until World War I. And it stunned the complacent Victorians to their core. The Zulu Kingdom was the creation of its legendary founder, Shaka. In the early 1800s, Shaka had emerged as the dominant chief among the Zulu tribes, and he had welded them into a powerful empire with himself at its head. Two keys to his success were his talents as a battlefield general and as an organizer. He favored an aggressive style of combat in which his armies sought to come to close grips with their foes and exterminate them. In battle, Zulu warriors were nearly naked, except for a large oval cowhide shield that was in the color of their regiment. They wielded short, broad-blade stabbing spears called assegai, as well as occasional light throwing spears and clubs. By the middle of the century, some guns had been obtained from European settlers, although these were typically of antiquated designs, and the gunpowder used by the Zulus was of dubious quality. The standard battle tactic Shaka employed was known as the horns of the bull, in which one section of the army, which was termed the chest, attacked straight on and held the enemy in place, while two other divisions, known as the left and the right horns, swept around to assault the foe from the sides and behind. It was a classic tactic of encirclement and annihilation, and he utilized it to devastating effect in building up his kingdom. Much of Shaka's power was derived from the Amabutho system he established, in which young, unmarried men were divided up into military regiments by age. Each regiment of similarly aged men had a strong group identity with its own name, insignia, and barracks. In times of all-out war, regiments of older, married men could also be summoned back into service. It was not a true standing army, but the men would spend a few months each year providing a labor force for the king, and then they were additionally available for call-up in emergencies. Shaka had been assassinated in 1828, but his system persevered. The current king, Cetshwayo, while not an inspirational battlefield warrior like Shaka, was an able administrator and actually desired good relations with his British neighbors. The commander-in-chief of the British forces in the war against the Zulus would be a man named Chelmsford. He was a stereotypical British aristocrat. He had attended Eton and served in various colonial posts. His career in the military was solid, but unremarkable. Perhaps his greatest weakness in the coming war lay in his rather condescending attitude towards the indigenous peoples, whom he clearly viewed as inferior. He once commented, "Natives must be thoroughly crushed to make them believe our superiority. And if I am called upon to conduct operations against them, I shall strive to be in a position to show them how hopelessly inferior to us they are in fighting power, although numerically stronger." This mentality would lead him to seriously underestimate the potential threat posed by the Zulu army. Another key figure in the battle would be Colonel Durnford. In contrast to Chelmsford, Durnford was clearly someone who was sympathetic and interested in the indigenous peoples, and he got along with them well. Probably for this reason, he was placed in charge of a contingent of mounted native troops within the British Army. Durnford had a reputation as being impulsive and too independent-minded, and Chelmsford seems to have distrusted him. In a skirmish, Durnford's left hand and arm had been crippled, so that he habitually carried his useless left hand thrust into his shirt, in the fashion stereotypically associated with Napoleon. Coastal regions of South Africa had been settled by mainly Dutch immigrants during the era of exploration, and their descendants were known as the Boers. In the early 19th century, the need for bases during the Napoleonic Wars had motivated the British to establish some colonies in the region. And for a while, all of these groups coexisted, along with indigenous nations such as the Zulu Empire. The discovery of diamonds, however, prompted the British to annex much more land, and the senior British administrators concocted a plan to create a new British-controlled confederation, which would incorporate all the previously independent groups. This was blatant imperialism, and in fact, the administrators started to put it into effect without having obtained official approval for their plans from England. Seeing the Zulu nation as an impediment to this scheme, the administrators who had previously had fairly amicable relations with the Zulus now began to look for an excuse to provoke a war with them. A minor border dispute had arisen between the Zulus and some Boers, and a commission was established to resolve it. This might have provided the excuse that they were so desperately looking for. But to the administrator's chagrin, the scrupulously honest commission found in favor of the Zulus. Nevertheless, at the meeting at which the Zulus were informed of the ruling, the administrators tacked onto it an outrageous ultimatum containing demands that they knew would be rejected by Cetshwayo. When, in due course, it was rejected, they fixed upon this supposed Zulu intransigence as their casus belli, and they declared war. Chelmsford was put in charge of the offensive, and he was given a force of about 12,000 men to accomplish the invasion. He chose to divide up his army into a three-pronged assault, with himself leading the main central column. While there were reasonable arguments having to do with logistics that could be made for dividing up his small army in this way, Chelmsford would consistently display a perhaps unwise propensity for subdividing his forces even further. King Cetshwayo realized that the English were intent on war, and that he really had no choice at all but to mobilize his men. Accordingly, he called up the various Mbutha regiments, and an army estimated at 25,000 men gathered at his capital by mid-January of 1879. There, they began to perform the complex rituals that were customary to do before battle. His scouts near the border were constantly observing the massing of the British columns, and so he knew exactly where each of them was located. Furthermore, the king and his advisors correctly identified the center British column as the primary offensive thrust, and they also recognized that their best chance was to concentrate their forces and try to destroy each British column separately. Therefore, he designated small detachments to harry and delay the right and left British columns, while his main force moved against the center one. This was quite likely the best plan that he could have adopted, and it showed both a keen awareness of strategy and the existence of a well-organized intelligence-gathering system. When word came that the British center column had crossed the Buffalo River into Zulu territory, the Zulu army set off to intercept it. By January 21st, they had moved swiftly and without being detected to within just 5 miles of the British. After crossing the river, Chelmsford and the British proceeded a short distance, and then they camped beneath a tall, oval, rocky outcrop called Isandlwana Hill. It jutted up dramatically from the surrounding landscape. The name Isandlwana literally means like a little hut, but it is a metaphorical term employed by the Zulu to indicate the second stomach of a cow. So, apparently, to the man who bestowed the name, the hill resembled that part of a bovine's anatomy. The English made their camp beneath the hill. They erected their tents in a long line that stretched nearly 800 meters. Altogether, there were about 300 large tents organized into blocks by unit. Behind them, closer to the base of the hill, were parked the supply wagons. While all of this created a very nice, neat, orderly appearance, the long, stretched-out nature of this camp was really not well-suited to defense. One of the main criticisms made of Chelmsford is that he did not fortify this camp by digging ditches or erecting walls or any sort of barrier, or at least drawing the heavy supply wagons together into a circular formation called a logger, which could serve as a impromptu but effective fort. And loggering up your wagons was a standard practice in South Africa for almost everyone when traveling out in the open. Just the previous year, Chelmsford himself had issued a set of regulations intended for units in the field, in which he dictated that camps should always be surrounded by entrenchments and wagons should always be loggered. Thus, he was actually ignoring his own instructions when he neglected to fortify the camp at Isandlwana. Chelmsford's second-in-command actually attempted to question this failure, only to have Chelmsford angrily respond, "It is not worthwhile. It will take too much time. And besides, most of the wagons are going back to Rorke's Drift." Clearly, Chelmsford considered the Isandlwana camp just a very temporary stop that would soon be abandoned, and so he didn't think it was worth the effort to try to fortify it. Additionally, although the main Zulu army was in fact lurking quite nearby, the British scouts had failed to detect it. Therefore, Chelmsford believed that there were no significant threats in the neighborhood, and that it was entirely safe to leave the camp unprotected. It was a serious mistake, and it reveals Chelmsford's overconfidence and his lack of respect for his enemy. The next day, Chelmsford sent out large scouting parties in a number of directions. Several of these reported having encountered small groups of Zulus. But it was not until after nightfall that word came of at least several hundred Zulus in some nearby hills. Now, this was not the main Zulu army, which still remained undiscovered. But Chelmsford decided to take about half of his troops and two-thirds of his cannon and try to catch this group that his scouts had sighted. And this was a move that would divide up his force yet again. He also sent an order to Colonel Durnford, who was further to the rear, instructing him to proceed to the main camp with his own column of mounted native troops. Chelmsford then rode out before dawn. But when he and his force arrived in the hills, they only encountered very small, isolated bands of Zulus. Disappointed, he decided he would settle down and have a nice, leisurely breakfast with his staff. Meanwhile, back at the main camp, reports had begun to come in of a large contingent of Zulus moving towards them. The officer who had been left in charge there, a man named Pauline, sent out some scouts, and he also, as a precautionary measure, had his men form a long, loose, curving defensive line several hundred yards out in front of the row of tents. Durnford arrived and decided to take some of his cavalry out to reconnoiter the terrain in front of the right side of the camp. Including Durnford's company, there were now about 1,700 men in and around the camp. One of Pauline's scouting groups, when they were about 4 miles out from the camp, spotted a few Zulus shepherding a herd of cows over the top of a ridge, and they pursued them. As the scouts rode up over the crest of the ridge, however, a sight unfolded beneath them which stopped them dead in their tracks with horror. Filling the valleys below were thousands upon thousands of silent Zulu warriors arrayed in their regiments. It was the main Zulu army. As one, this mass of warriors rose up and sprang towards the terrified scouts. They fired off one volley and then fled before the onrushing tide of Zulus. Tense and keyed up by the long, quiet period of waiting, the Zulu regiments could now not be restrained by their officers, and they ran forward after the retreating scouts in the direction of the camp beneath Isandlwana. Although the battle started in this spontaneous manner, the regiments soon shook themselves out and formed the classic Horns of the Bull formation. Several regiments of experienced older men constituted the center chess group, with others shaping themselves into the right horn, which set out on a long, curving jog that would eventually bring them around the backside of the hill of Isandlwana. The very youngest regiment formed the tip of the left horn, and this was appropriate because they also had a long distance to run, swinging far to the left and then coming back towards the main British camp from that side. As they rode along, Durnford's group ran straight into the approaching left horn of the Zulu army. Durnford coolly had his men dismount, take shelter in one of the many little gullies that crisscrossed the area, and open fire on them. This served to slow the onrush of the Zulus a bit, but there were far too many of them to stop. And so Durnford and his men fell back, shot another volley, and then moved back again. In this fashion, they fought a slow retreat back towards the main camp. A little unit of artillerymen equipped with rockets had been following Durnford, and bravely they set up their iron rocket launchers, but they only managed to get off a single rocket before they were overrun and all of them were killed. Back at the camp, the terrain hid the movements of the encircling left horn, but the right horn and that solid body of the chest regiments were seen approaching. The thin, extended line of British troops, the core of which was composed of men from the 1st Battalion of the 24th Regiment, opened fire. These were very experienced European soldiers. They calmly sighted their targets and poured a steady barrage of bullets into the approaching masses. The two cannons that were present at the camp joined in, And confronted by this substantial firepower, the Zulu advance ground to a halt.